This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And you know, you can listen to The Takeaway anytime by subscribing to our podcast. You can find that on our website, thetakeaway.org, or on iTunes. Lawmakers explaining health care reform. Sometimes it seems like you're in a hospital waiting room, you know?
We got 5 years stuck on my...
When a young man was courting a young woman, and they were driving down the road, and they'd hit a bump in the road, and she'd fall toward him, he'd say, "Thank you, ma'am."
Speed bumps? Thank you, ma'am? So that's the holdup, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, a discussion of ancient dating practices?
So a bump in the road became equated with "thank you, ma'am." So we have a few "thank you, ma'ams" going on around here when we're dealing with a bill of this size.
I'm down. Thank you, ma'am.
Oh, thank you for that, Madam Speaker. Suffragettes, that we get on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
More Bowie. Good morning, everyone. It's Friday, July 31st. I'm John Hockenberry. Amy Holmes is with us all week, former Senate speechwriter, political analyst, and, you know, for this week, co-host of The Takeaway. I
say
good morning.
It's been a pleasure. On the show today, Washington's beer diplomacy and healthcare brouhahas, and all eyes are on the economy. We'll look into the magic GDP 8-ball. Yes, no, more information. And why we're watching more extreme cooking on TV.
Extreme cooking? What do you mean, Amy?
We have Julia in the studio right now. While we talk to Michael Palin of the New York Times Magazine. But first, we bring you Takeaway Washington correspondent Ted Zawilik. Todd, lots of news on healthcare this week. We just heard that awkward Pelosi clip of falling down on speed bumps for the president, something like that. Was that just a convoluted way of saying they missed his deadline?
Good morning, Amy. Well, probably. First, it was the speaker's, the president's deadline, and then it was Congress's deadline. Harry Reid went so far as yesterday to say the press made up the deadline, so who cares if they meet it? But the job now is for members to go home in August and convince voters that they're doing the right thing, either by opposing this big government takeover or by passing a bill that's going to take insurance companies out of your way once and for all. Depends on what side you're on.
So they'll be working very hard this summer for their constituents. Todd Zawilik, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thank you, and stay with us. We'll continue the conversation with you in just a few moments.
And just quickly, we're going to give you everything you need to know in the news and the headlines. The House is expected to pass legislation today to give the government a direct role in deciding how much Wall Street execs get paid. The government's billion-dollar cash for clunkers program, so popular it's now broke, the Transportation Department told auto dealers last night to stop offering rebates for folks who trade in their old ride for one that's more fuel efficient.
And this hour, we'll find out how the U.S. economy is doing. The president says he expects the latest GDP report to show the economy shrank last quarter. He added that job losses are still a problem.
And there's word that the U.S. general in charge of turning around the war in Afghanistan may ask for more troops. And in Baghdad, at least 24 are dead in bombings that targeted 3 Shiite mosques as worshippers left Friday prayers. The Dow opens next hour at 9154. The S&P starts trading at 987. And the Nasdaq begins at 1984. Futures trading suggests a positive opening to end the week as Wall Street's on a roar. The House heads out for summer break today. The Senate goes next week. Do you think they deserve a break after all they've done with the speed bumps and the thank you, ma'am stuff? Say thank you, ma'am, to your lawmaker at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. A recess constituent town meeting on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Happy Friday. Here with Amy Holmes, who's joined me all week. And I have to say, you know, we begin in Washington, as we almost do, but that had to be the most excruciatingly awkward and unspontaneous beers that were ever drunk on the face of planet Earth last night at the White House.
So were you shocked to see the president and vice president in their shirt sleeves?
There must have been so many committees on so many levels doing all of the details there. But I don't know, maybe I'm just cynical, but you do have to ask the question, was it health reform this week with a beer chaser or beer with a health reform chaser. Here's Sergeant James Crowley at the beer summit last night.
What you had today was two gentlemen agree to disagree on a particular issue. I don't think that we spent too much time dwelling on the past. We spent a lot of time discussing the future.
Which might have been a theme for lawmakers actually dealing with something in Washington, like health care reform. Todd Zwillick staying with us, of course, the Takeaway's Washington correspondent down in Washington, D.C. Also, Callie Crossley, media critic for Beat the Press on our partner WGBH up in Boston. Callie, good morning.
Good morning.
Todd Zwillick, let me put it to you. Was it beer with a health reform chaser this week or health reform with a beer chaser?
Oh, I'd like to think it was health reform with a beer chaser.
About health reform then. They are disagreeing. I don't know if they're agreeing to disagree, but where does it stand on this Friday as we get into the recess?
Well, Henry Waxman's Energy and Commerce Committee went late into the night last night. He finally got his markup. That was one of the thank you, ma'ams, sorry, speed bumps that the speaker was talking about in that opening that you used, John. And then they head into the August recess, and the August recess is all about message. You know, they wanted to vote on this before they left. That didn't happen. Now you've got a month of members hanging out there in one of three positions, either defend the Democratic sort of Obama plan for healthcare as hard as they can, try to get people over on their side. Don't forget, the president's numbers are slipping on this. Democrats think they have a big education sale job to do. If you don't know how you're going to vote, you got to listen hard to your constituents and try to come up with a justification for voting either yay or nay. Or if you're a Republican, oppose it, call it big government takeover, go after it, and call it socialism. That's the strategy.
Well, Todd, I mean, I have to say that of all the, you know, blue dog Democrat arguments for delaying here, this is the one that really does hold some credence for me. Go home, listen to your constituents. But there was a premise set up last night, both by Nancy Pelosi and by House Minority Leader John Boehner, that I wonder if we could explore for a moment. First, let's hear what John Boehner believes about how this constituent discussion is going to go over the next couple of weeks.
And now on the way to out of town for the August break, they're cutting deals on a government takeover of health care that will raise costs, drive up the deficits, and destroy jobs in America. On health care, it's pretty clear that the more Americans hear about the president's health care plan, the less that they like it.
Okay, Takeaway listeners, did you get that? The more Americans hear about the health care plan, the less they like it. Now, here's Nancy Pelosi, okay, stating a slightly different theory about how the constituents are going to respond.
The more the public knows about what we're doing, the more they support it. And especially if you're talking about a public option, because that's where the insurance companies are making their attack.
I'm confused, Todd. Which is it?
And that's exactly the dichotomy that's going to be going on during August. Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats unveiled their message strategy for August, and they were pretty clear about it. It says it has two things. You know, John, I want to point out real quick, when members leave for August, they actually get marching orders. It's on a card, and it's called a flyaway card. You fly away from Washington, here's what the leadership wants you to say about this bill while you're at home. It says a whole bunch of things. It really lays out what this bill means to you if you have insurance, which is what you heard the president talking about this week. It'll lower your costs. They can't rescind you. They can't raise your premiums. They can't deny you for pre-existing conditions. You know, all that stuff.
But Todd, you know, I have a question about that. We've been hearing this week, we heard from Congressman Wiener yesterday, that there's real dissent in Democratic ranks. We know that on the Republican side, there's unanimity. They're going to go after this, you know, as hard as they can. But when Democrats go home, what do the progressives say to their constituents?
They say exactly what Nancy Pelosi said yesterday. She sharpened her message, Amy. She really sharpened it against insurance companies. She is taking a populist tack. She's got a boogeyman, and it's the insurance companies. They're standing between you and your doctor.
Villains.
No doubt about it.
It's
been effective in the past, and that's exactly where they're going this August.
Well, Todd, thanks so much. Takeaway's Washington correspondent in Washington, D.C. Callie Crossley, media critic for Beat the Press on our partner WGBH in Boston. How did the media do at covering this beer summit yesterday, which I'm scratching my head?
I say it's not your grandmother's kumbaya. That's how the media did.
Nice.
They just were trying to figure out some place to land, and they got nothing, really. I think the big symbolism is they were kept back so far that they couldn't hear. They got a beautifully poised statement from Sergeant Crowley at the end with no understanding of what Professor Gates really thinks. I mean, he made some brief statements and a promise that there's more to come. It's not over yet.
You're a media critic. This is Amy here. Do you think that the media overplayed this whole beer summit issue? I mean, healthcare is a sixth of the economy, the size of France. You know, arguably, that's the much bigger story.
It is the much bigger story, but people are not paying attention to it. I think Todd was quite clear about that, and they're confused about it. One thing that people were not confused about, if you listen to talk radio and if you read the comments about all of the stories that have been done, people have lined up on sides, and they're, as I see it, the summit actually was moving in the direction of hardening the sides, where people felt they how they felt about the incident that had happened. And in fact, all of the principal said we have to agree to disagree, so they don't. The kumbaya moment was lost even at the White House.
Well, let's bring in Philip Martin into this discussion. Go right to the bar stools in Boston and find out what real people were saying about this summit. Reporter Philip Martin was right there at Ground Zero as the president was convening the beer summit last night. Philip, can you tell us a little bit about where you were? Set the stage for us.
Yeah, I was at Frank Doyle's. Good morning, everyone. First,
good morning.
Of all.
Good morning.
I was at Frank Doyle's, which is a pretty becoming a well-known Boston Irish pub. I mean, we have more Irish pubs in Boston than we have Dunkin' Donuts, and this is the one where Sergeant Crowley basically received the phone call from President Obama last Friday. It's a cops bar, and I spoke to several of them there. They were excited to see their colleague on the air and meeting with the president, and they were particularly excited that, in one cop's words, that this thing is over.
Well, I love these voices. These are
yes,
great.
Yeah. Let's take a listen to some of the folks that you chatted with last night.
I think everybody's got a little responsibility on this, and you know, we learn from the mistakes and move on. Everybody sits and has a beer, and you know.
Gotcha. What are you drinking?
I'm drinking Blue Moon. What Sergeant Crowley is drinking?
Perhaps this was just the way that it needed to end, to try and dissipate, you know, the bad will, the bad feeling that had gone on with the whole, you know, black, white race. Perhaps this was just their way of saying, okay, let's go and have a beer, lads. Let's go talk. Let's have a yarn with each other.
That's so great.
That is great. Philip, when you were listening last night, did the president succeed in creating this teachable moment that he was talking about?
It depends. And by the way, I should have said Tommy Doyle's, not Frank Doyle's. My apologies.
Yeah, how long were you in the pubs last night, Philip? Jeez.
Have another cup of coffee.
Too long. Clearly. It was teachable in the sense that he held this summit, and people were excited about it. They felt it was a culmination of what had been a bad week in one sense for the Cambridge Police Department. On the other hand, they felt that one cop genuinely called it a teachable moment and felt that people had actually learned. He's a 30-year veteran. He actually felt that people had learned something from this.
Well, what exactly did they
incident.
Think that they had learned
yeah.
from it? You know,
he felt that from what he was hearing on the streets, he wasn't just talking about, of course, the summit. But he was talking about what he was hearing from people he was interacting with every day in Cambridge. And he was hearing it from both sides.
And in Cambridge, how many universities are there in Cambridge? I mean, they're all about teachable moments up in Cambridge. I mean, that's really not all they do up there. Callie Crossley, so, you know, Crowley was drinking Blue Moon. Does Blue Moon beer become the beer of white, racially questionable cops, or does it become the beer of reconciliation?
I think beer becomes the drink of reconciliation at this moment, even though Sergeant Crowley himself said they need to move on to tea to really set a teachable moment. I think what happens here is that there were a lot of high hopes put on moving forward in this conversation, and that, of course, this is going to get a lot of attention because we have the first African-American president who has the credibility
right.
to be able to engage in this kind of conversation.
Great conversation this morning on The Takeaway. Callie Crossley, media critic for Beat the Press at our partner WGN. WGBH in Boston. And also up there in Boston, Philip Martin, radio reporter. Philip, thanks so much for going out and doing that research for us last night. I know it was tough on you.
Thank you. It was tough. Somebody had to do it.
Teachable moments in Cambridge, Massachusetts. They've been doing it for a long time, eh, Amy?
Yes, they've got that history.
Yeah, PhDs in Kumbaya down in Washington this morning.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Amy Holmes. Well, the show's going really well this morning.
Oh, I think so, too.
I just have one question.
What's that?
Where's our bonus, right?
Yeah.
Performance-based bonus, huh? Where is it?
I think we should have one.
I think we should. Look at the numbers in the banking industry, all right? Back before the record profits or the big profits that were reported for the last quarter, 5,000 people in the banking industry got $1 million bonuses. Got to get into this.
John,
business.
We're in the wrong business.
We are in the wrong business. Like Louise Story, a business reporter for our partner, The New York Times, she's here in the studios. The headlines are coming in this morning from New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo, who's been tracking executive bonuses at the top banks in New York for quite a while. The numbers are still shocking. After some really serious profits for Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase, and some other banks, now we get this bonus information. Louise, what do we look for in the details?
Well, these are the bonuses that were paid last December. Remember, it was just a month or so after they got the bailout money. What's new here is we're finding out how rich the top earners were paid. We didn't know if the billions in bonuses were spread out over everyone or if there were a few people who made a lot. And it turns out there really were a few who made a lot.
And in fact, how they cut the bonus pool is one of the most closely guarded secrets in banking, right?
Absolutely. They keep it a secret what size the total bonus pool is and who gets the most.
But Louise, isn't this a part of the way that bankers get compensated, that they sign contracts, that this is, you know, how they get paid?
A lot of them do have guaranteed bonuses. However, you know, at its root, a bonus is supposed to be somewhat discretionary based on how you and the company performs.
But, you know, I wonder if that's the case. I wonder if what we're learning in this whole financial meltdown is that, in fact, the banking business isn't about that at all. It's not really about performance. It's about other people's money comes in, gets traded, it gets, invested, and then the profits from that money get put into this bonus pool. That is the business. There is no other business. It just happens to be, in this case, the money came from the taxpayers last December. And it's a minor detail to these bankers, apparently.
That's what Cuomo claims. He's saying that pay for performance
is
broken.
She went New York Times. They don't go there. That's what Cuomo claims, she said.
But what you're seeing is an interesting dichotomy between what the average common sense may say to you, which is that performance should be close to the bank's profits, versus what people on Wall Street think is that performance, my own performance, should drive what I'm paid.
Well, it's great information, and we're going to get some more information from you later on in the morning. Louise Story, business reporter for The New York Times. There's more economic news going on today.
Also with us in the studio this morning is our friend Lakshman Akshutan. He's the managing director of the Economic Cycle Research Institute. Thank you. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
So the GDP numbers are out today.
Yes.
What are they telling us?
Well, they're going to be a little less negative, a little less bad will be the tenor of all.
A little less bad.
Less bad. But that's actually a really good thing, because if we keep this in perspective, and that's important here, I think a lot of people lose perspective. In the fourth quarter of last year, we were shrinking at over a 6% rate. Then in the first quarter, it was a little over a 5% rate. If people's guesstimates are right, we're now shrinking at about a 1.5% rate. That's a lot. In other words, we've turned the corner. And this is telling us what happened in the rearview mirror also. It's not telling us anything about today. It's not telling us anything about tomorrow. It's telling you about the last
year. How Lakshman goes. Yeah, he's all about the lagging. The lagging indicators.
Well, just got to keep them in perspective. They're not all equal.
And talking of lagging indicators, yesterday the number of newly laid off workers filing for first-time claims for jobless benefits went up. Is this good news or bad news?
Well, week to week, it's very, very jumpy. And the fact that it went up is, on the face of it, undeniably bad, okay?
Right.
But you have to look at it over time. This is every week we're getting a piece of data. It's jumping up and down. And if you look at it, if you step back, it's down from these 600 levels every week down to
600,000 levels.
Yeah, so now it's down to five. So the trend is getting better. Less people are getting laid off.
So here's something I don't understand. Why is unemployment considered a lagging indicator?
Okay, because basically if a business starts to feel better, and do a little bit better, the first thing it's going to do is make you work more before it hires someone else.
Oh, I see.
And so therefore, you know, business managers really wait until they have no choice but to hire someone new, because hiring someone new...
Yeah, that's really nice. Nice. That's really excellent, Lakshman. So let's talk. Unemployment is a lagger, right?
Uh-huh.
GDP, which comes out today, is a lagging...
Coincidence.
It's like now and maybe a little bit recent history.
Yes.
So are all the leading indicators still smiling? You predicted the recession was over, right?
Yeah. Back in April, looking at leading indicators, only out the front windshield, we're seeing these leading indicators soaring. Ever since then, they've been getting stronger and stronger, literally unrelenting rise. So it's telling us that the recovery in GDP that we're seeing is going to continue. And at the end of the year, in January, when we're looking back, we're going to say, wow, look, we started to actually recover sometime this summer.
So for us non-economists, what is a leading indicator? And what are you talking about?
Yeah, sure. Well, I think initial jobless claims is one. The stock market is a very imperfect leading indicator.
And it's been going
way up.
And actually, futures trading suggests another positive opening for the Dow and S&P.
Because they're looking even farther forward. It's really about profits growth. And just now we were talking about, hey, bonuses are being paid out because people are starting to make money. Yeah, the financial sector is an extreme situation. But even the more...
Well, extreme? Wait a minute. I mean, you ask these guys if there even was a recession, they'd go, what recession? They have no perception of a recession. These guys are getting bonuses all along.
When you get a bonus that big, you can retire on the bonus practically. So
but while unemployment is still going up, Warren Buffett, he warns that it might go up to 11%.
Yeah.
How is the average person going to look around and see that the recession is over? Like the cover of Newsweek, we talked to Daniel Gross this week, and you know,
he listens to you quite a lot.
Sure, yeah. Well, the average person will sense that, look, we're not falling off a cliff, and I think a lot of people are already sensing that the falling into the abyss part and that fear seems to have receded.
Although that isn't being reflected in consumer confidence numbers.
No, well, you know, consumer confidence, it's coming off the mat and it's gotten a little bit better. It hasn't plunged to new lows. And I suspect with the jobs market that that's going to slowly improve. I want to point out something that's not very egalitarian, that the top 10%, the wealthiest 10% in this country, account for 50% of all things that consumers spend. Okay, so you actually don't need 90% of consumers to feel that much better in order for the economy to start.
I don't know if I should feel good about that or grab a pitchfork.
I'm not.
I don't know.
So are we going to see people start, you know, going back to Target in bigger numbers, going to Home Depot and spending this money?
Yeah,
feeling confident.
I think you're all in retrospect, you're going to see this retail sales. What happens at cash registers? You're going to start to see that recover. It'll probably even be at some of the more expensive stores that you'll start to see that happen.
Thank you. That's interesting stuff. You were listening to Lakshman Achuthan, Managing Director of the Economic Cycle Research Institute, and Louise Story of the New York Times.
Used to be trickle-down economics, now it's a hose-down economics. The rich are going to spend us out of this recession. Oh, I don't know if I should feel so good about that. Anyway, coming up on the program, a federal judge has some good news for a detainee, what's believed to be the Guantanamo Bay's youngest detainee. We hear from one of his lawyers, ordered released by a federal judge. That's still ahead right here on The Takeaway. We'll be right back.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at GatesFoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at RockFound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Amy Holmes. In just a moment, a look at the GDP figures just out this morning. Maybe a little better news than we thought, a contraction of only about 1%. But first, a federal judge has ordered the release of what one can only hope is Guantanamo Bay's youngest detainee. Mohammed Jawad has been detained there since 2002. He was arrested in Kabul, Afghanistan, for throwing a hand grenade, allegedly that injured two American troops and their Afghan interpreter. His lawyers claim he was likely a teenager at the time. Joining us is one of the attorneys defending Mohammed Jawad, Jonathan Hafitz. Jonathan, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
First of all, how much does the apparent youth of this defendant figure into the judge's decision?
Well, I think it certainly figures in. His abuse and his torture figured in prominently at an earlier stage 2 weeks ago, where the judge threw out his supposed confessions to Afghan and U.S. officials as the product of torture. And I think it secondly figures in terms of just underscoring what an outrage this case is. But what drove the judge was the lack of any credible evidence against Mr. Jawad.
Now, if it was the case that he threw a hand grenade at soldiers, that's one thing. But as you say, the judge says there's no credible evidence for this. But it seems to me that at some point the argument against his release has crystallized around the idea that he's a threat now because he's been in Gitmo for so long. Describe how the government is making that argument, and isn't that the government's fault in this case?
Well, they're not. I don't know that they're making that argument exactly, and I think there's no basis to it in any event. You know, I was just down visiting with Mr. Jawad earlier this week. His military council member, individuals who have served in our nation's forces, have spent hours upon hours with him over the past years, and he's emerged from this nightmare ordeal remarkably intact, not bitter. He wants to go home to his family and has talked about trying to get an education and becoming a doctor. So I think that argument that he is sort of he's become dangerous by his experience at Gitmo, there's nothing to it.
Well, Jonathan, we should point out once again that you are one of his attorneys. It appears he's spent half of his life at Gitmo. How old do you think he is?
Well, we're not certain, though. The Afghan government says he was as young as 12 when he was taken from Afghanistan, rendered to Bagram, the U.S. prison there, and then Guantanamo. Our best guess is he was around, 15 at the time. So really, a young boy, a young teenager, stripped from his home, beaten, forced into sleep deprivation program, and just taken halfway across the world in a terrifying experience, just locked up without any access to the court or the outside world for years.
So, Jonathan, this is Amy Holmes here. Following on John's point that the government says he may have been radicalized at Gitmo, what can you tell us as his lawyer is his attitude towards the United States?
Well, I think, obviously he's, it's hard for him to have lost so many years of his life, but he's not bitter, and he wants to, he's really just trying to maintain positive and is looking forward and is, at this point cautiously optimistic
right.
that this nightmare is coming to an end and that he can go back to his mother, his family, and his country.
Now, Jonathan,
which I should add has demanded his return.
Right. Now, Jonathan, you say that the judge says there's no credible evidence against him. You believe there's nothing we don't know about this defendant, Mohammed Jawad. But what if Vice President Cheney comes out tomorrow and says, actually, I've seen the classified documents. The man is a major terrorist. What would you say to that?
Well, I would say he's a liar because we've seen or he's misinformed. We've seen all the evidence. I can't discuss it, but I can tell you it's not new. It's been around, lying around for months, and it's not credible. And I think that the proof of the pudding is in the fact that they did not present this evidence right. When there was a hearing before a federal judge.
And the judge released him, which is another kind of proof. Congratulations, I guess, are in order for you and your legal team, Jonathan Hafitz. Thanks so much for joining us. Jonathan is an attorney in the National Security Project at the ACLU, defending Mohammed Jawad, who was ordered released by a federal judge. He's believed to be Guantanamo Bay's youngest detainee.
And now back to more economic news. Just out 5 minutes ago, the GDP shrank 1% in the second quarter. To tell us more about what that means, we're now joined by Dan Gross, columnist for Newsweek and Slate.com. Thank you, Dan.
Good morning.
So we found out just 5 minutes ago that the GDP only shrank 1%. That's actually better than the prediction that we got from Lakshman earlier in the program. What do you say about this?
Well, in order for the economy to start growing again, it has to stop falling at a the pace it was, which was negative 6% almost in the fourth quarter of 2008 and first quarter of 2009. And what this is a sign of is that there's these natural self-correcting mechanisms in the economy that we're working off those excesses, but also that huge intervention that we saw last fall with the Federal Reserve and continuing with the stimulus package is working in the sense that it is stopped the rate of decline.
So do you believe that the TARP was essential to this recovery?
I think it was essential to the stabilization. And I think this is the big misnomer. There was this sense when we were selling the TARP and those bailouts and all the stuff the Fed was doing that if we do this, we'll go back to the good times of 2006, 2007 when money is basically free and everyone's having a great party. The reality is that they were just trying to avert Armageddon. The system was in full meltdown mode, and it took this huge amount of resources just to get it to stop melting down. That's what we've done so far. The challenge is now how we get back to a path of sustainable growth.
Dan, on the pain question, people who are actually feeling the recession, we've got a pretty interesting statistic. The employment costs have risen by the lowest amount on record for the 12 months ending in June. That relates to wages and people in the real economy, right?
Well, that's all about supply and demand. There is a large number of people who are looking for work. The unemployment rate is 9.5%, highest it's been in a generation. And you add in all the people who are working part-time but want to be working full-time. There is vast underutilization of sort of human capital in this economy. And so if you are a employer and you're hiring somebody, you don't feel the need to sort of boost somebody's wages, right? You have the pick of the litter now.
So the GDP is sort of a big amorphous thing that the average person doesn't necessarily really feel. When is the average person listening to our broadcast going to feel this recession that you said very boldly on the cover of Newsweek is over?
Yes, we said we boldly proclaimed the recession over and then had an asterisk saying good luck surviving the recovery. We had a jobless recovery the last time we had a recession. Remember that it ended in November 01, but we continued to lose jobs through the middle of 2003. Economists think we're looking at something similar. GDP is a technical calculation involving, how much imports came down and exports went up and revisions to certain calculations that were made before. For most people, of course, it has to do with whether they have a job, whether their neighbor has a job. Economists are generally projecting that the unemployment rate will continue to rise, perhaps linger at 10% through next year, and maybe only in the second half of 2010 will we really start to see the unemployment rate come down. We need to create about 140,000 jobs a month to get the unemployment rate to go down. We're still losing jobs.
Well, we'll certainly be keeping our eye on that number. Dan Gross, thanks for joining us. Columnist for Newsweek and Slate.com.
Coming up,
Julia Child, Top Chef, and Michael Pollan on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Amy Holmes. And it's Friday on The Takeaway, and that means it's time to talk movies. So Judd Apatow is Hollywood's latest golden boy. He's been filling up those movie theater seats. He has a film coming out this weekend called Funny People, starring Adam Sandler, Seth Rogen, and Jonah Hill. Here's Adam Sandler in Funny People, playing George Simmons, a stand-up comedian.
I like having a girlfriend. I don't have one, but I like it better. One night stands are tough, and I'm not great at sex, so at the end of every time, I got to look at him and go, hey, normally I do better than that. Girlfriends are so much better. You know, you finish up and you're just like, well, you know. That's how I do it.
Joining us here in the studio to give us her review of Funny People is film critic Michelle Orange. Welcome.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Can you give us just a quick synopsis of Funny People?
Sure. Funny People, it's the story of this famous comedian named George Simmons who, when we meet him, has just been diagnosed with a terminal illness, and he hires this stand-up comedian named Ira, played by Seth Rogen, to be a sort of errand boy slash joke writer, and the first half of the movie is concerned with the bond that develops between these two men as George sort of gets his affairs in
order.
Teacher
and student?
Yeah, a little bit of that. Mentor.
Mm-hmm. Aside from the terminal illness, it's kind of a memoir for all these guys, isn't it? And growing up
a
as
little
comedian.
Bit, I think
yeah,
so. There's
strange.
A lot of autobiographical elements in there. And then George sort of miraculously recovers from his illness and decides that his life...
Of course, in Hollywood they...
it's amazing. And
redemption.
Yeah, and he decides that his life hasn't been what he wanted it to be, and the first thing he wants to do to rectify that is hunt down this old love from his past named Laura, who's played by Leslie Mann.
So let's talk about that. Judd Apatow has been hugely successful, making piles and piles of money with his sort of comedic formula. Actresses, they must be dying to get into his movies.
Yeah, they probably are. It seems like his wife gets the plum rolls, but yeah, I'm sure they are.
But I understand from you that you take issue with his depiction of women.
I do, you know, and this film, I mean, his films on their own terms, they work. They're about dudes. They're about dudeness, but there's always, there are women in there who... And this film is sort of the full realization of the Apatow world where, you know, it centers on male bonding and it's about humor and the role that it plays in male relationships. The thing for me is that the way that the men relate and compete and understand each other and sort of gain each other's respect is through humor. And the problem is that the women, it just becomes more problematic to me that the women aren't funny because they can't actually...
Well, you know, I got to take issue with you with that a little bit. I thought Catherine Keener, for example, in 40-Year-Old Virgin was hilarious. She was quirky. She was strange. Leslie Mann, as you mentioned, Apatow's wife, who gets cast quite a bit. She has lots of comedic moments in his movies, like as in Knocked Up. And looking at sort of the man theme here, doesn't he talk a lot about man boys having to grow up, throw out the bong, man up and take your responsibilities?
It's true. And this film is also, to a certain extent, about the sort of long, slow grind towards maturity, but I feel like it's a what I mean when I say the women aren't funny is that they don't interact with the men in the same way that the men interact. It's a bonding issue.
Do you like this film? Do you like this film?
I did. I had reservations about it, but ultimately it's a good film. I feel like he was trying to make a masterpiece in a way, in a kind of opus.
So bottom line, you tell people to go to the theaters
if
this weekend
like
and see
films,
it?
If you like his films, yeah.
Judd, more laugh lines for the ladies. that's the takeaway here?
I'm just saying.
Michelle, thanks so much for joining us. That was Michelle Orange, freelance film critic, here and in the studio.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining whether states have the right to legislate the foods and restaurants that people choose. Is it a responsible way to make communities healthier, or does it violate freedom of choice? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here with Amy Holmes. We got new names who tested positive in baseball for performance-enhancing drugs. Can you guess them? Here's a hint. Manny, Poppy. We'll get all the details coming up next. Right now, more of the top news stories. Amy?
The House is expected to pass a bill today laying ground for a new government say on Wall Street compensation. Supporters say lavish pay packages encourage execs to take risks that can threaten the entire economy. Critics say the bill gets the government just in too deep into directing private business.
Clunkers, do you feel like a clunker this morning? Check cash running out. The White House is reassessing the Cash for Clunkers program. Don't know if you've participated in that, but it gives money to new car buyers who trade up gas guzzlers for more efficient cars. It's proving so popular that money set aside is drying up fast. U.S. officials say the top commander in Afghanistan may ask for more American troops. General Stanley McChrystal is finishing a full review of the effort there.
And we've just been talking about those latest GDP numbers. They show a 1% second quarter slip in the U.S. economy. That's a smaller contraction than earlier this year. Mexico watches those numbers, too. Its government now says the country has lost nearly 600,000 jobs just in the last year.
Wow, and those are the stories that we are following this morning. Also, sports this morning. As I said at the top of the hour, new names in the performance-enhancing drug scandal in baseball. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is with us, the Takeaway Sports contributor. 2000 and year, remember back. 2003, remember back. The Boston Red Sox won the pennant, won the World Series. The curse was over. But David Ortiz, who hit it deep back then...
Yes, and it's gone. Second home run of 2009 for David Ortiz. Oh, what a welcome sight for Red Sox Nation. Big Poppy's gone deep.
But he's been struggling in 2009. Big Poppy struggling in 09, but back in 03 he helped win the pennant because, maybe, he's a part of the steroids controversy. We know that Manny Ramirez was, but the fact that it happened in 2003 might have contributed to the Boston Red Sox victory. That's a big deal. Baseballers are worried this morning. Ibrahim, explain.
The New York Times headline basically says, Red Sox fans stand by Ortiz. And when you have a guy like David Ortiz who steps into the batter's box, Big Poppy, he's huge, he's strong. And when he hits that bat in a clutch situation, he makes the ball go a long, long way. The Red Sox fans are never going to turn away from him, but it does taint the 2004 and 2007 World Series.
And does it explain that Big Poppy has been struggling this year, that maybe if he's off steroids, he's off his game?
I think a lot of folks were looking at that in the beginning of the season saying, what's going on with Big Poppy? And it was, you know, maybe he's old, maybe he doesn't have it anymore, maybe his knees are done, maybe whatever it was. But now we know that it might be a little bit just that maybe he decided to get off of it. But this doesn't mince the fact that actually players have a natural talent, and it's not the steroids that make you better, but steroids do make you recover better.
Well, the deep baseball story here before we go is really that these allegations come from that list, the notorious
Correct.
List that the Players Association had as a secret list that they actually tested the players. And from this list, we learned that A-Rod was actually a steroid user, and that was Selena Roberts' big, huge story in Sports Illustrated. Where is this list now? Why wasn't it destroyed? It was supposed to be. Are we going to continue to hear these allegations?
There's definitely a leak, and the list of 104, we're still going to continue to get a trickle of this leak, and it's going to be a rolling sort of scandal until they finally decide to shut it down or to just, you know, let it be known who's on that list.
Well, Manny Ramirez, of course, did his time. He's back playing. Ortiz, anything happened to him at this point before we go?
Ortiz himself, he said, I think in the beginning of the year, he said, if anyone's caught for using steroids, then they should be suspended for 1 year.
Wow.
So maybe he'll self-impose a suspension. I seriously doubt it. The Major League Baseball could use that against him.
All right, but it's a hot pennant race between the Red Sox and the Yankees.
Indeed,
I doubt
indeed.
Anyone will want to derail that. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor, thanks so much.
Of this menu, I'm going to show you how to do the peas and the steak Diane and the chocolate cake. And this chocolate cake is made out of 1 pound of chocolate and whipped cream and rum and eggs. And here are the eggs.
Yum. That sounds good. That
was... I love butter and chocolate and all those things.
Good things. That was the legendary Julia Child, of course, cooking it old school with all of the good stuff. In this segment, we're joined by the renowned writer about food and the business of food, Michael Pollan. Michael has a story in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine about the rise of cooking shows and the curious decline of cooking at home. Michael is the author of a raft of hugely popular books, including In Defense of Food. Michael, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you, Amy. Good to be here.
Terrific. So you say that Top Chef and Who Wants to Be a Food TV's Next Cooking Star are actually taking Americans out of the kitchen in front of the television. It seems sort of counterintuitive, I suppose.
Well, they're very different shows than Julia Child. I mean, Julia Child was all about empowering you and giving you the courage to cook something as intimidating as French, French hot cuisine. These other shows are really about watching other people do it because they unfold so quickly. I mean, it's more like watching a sports event when you watch Top Chef. And you would never, you know, there's nothing, you learn nothing. I mean, it just goes by way too fast.
We have an example of that, a Spike from season 4 of Top Chef. Let's take a listen.
I was just like, boom, boom, boom. I was just attacking my prep work. And that's who I am as a chef. So it was nice to show some people, hey, listen, I'm here to compete. I'm here to do the best. And I'm right on the money with all of that.
Michael, is that even cooking? That sounds more like warfare.
It's ESPN, actually. I mean, it's exactly like a post-game or pre-game interview on ESPN.
With a Pilates soundtrack, it sounds like.
Exactly. And you know, that's how they're designed. I mean, they're very well-produced shows. You know, and I find them very entertaining, I have to say. But it's not about cooking. It's about cooking as a spectator sport. What's interesting is that cooking should be a subject of a spectator sport that people want to watch.
Huh.
And the paradox that I try to deal with in the article is, why are we so eager to watch cooking on TV, yet so not eager to do it ourselves? Because the number of Americans who cook is in steady decline.
Well, steady, maybe. Really? It's declining?
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, it's you know, I mean, you hear lots about cooking, and it's, you know, it has a lot of cultural prestige as an activity, but nobody's really doing it. Only 58% of meals in America are cooked at home, but if you look at the definition of cooking, it's pretty mild. Anything involving assembly of ingredients qualifies as cooking.
Well, Michael, I have to say that sounds
cooking.
Exactly. That sounds very familiar to me. I mean, in the interest of full disclosure, I don't think I've cooked a single meal in like the past 3 weeks, unless you count, you know, pouring cereal into a bowl and adding milk.
Michael, actually, do you have a recipe for boiling an egg for Amy? She was talking about that this morning.
You know, I mean, for a single person especially, cooking is a lot of work. It's really expensive. And you just want to go to a restaurant where they'll get it right and they'll clean the dishes. Isn't that reasonable?
Well, I don't know if it's more expensive than going to a restaurant. But, look, we have so many reasons not to cook these days. You know, we're really busy. And we're tempted by a food industry that you know, tells us why bother.
Right.
We'll do it for you. We're happy to do it for you.
But what's going to happen? I mean, you grew up on Julia Childs. I grew up on Graham Kerr. Remember guy?
Sure.
The Galloping Gourmet. And, you know, they all opened the door to people like us to actually do cooking. And you say cooking is in decline. Does Top Chef signal the end of an era?
Yeah. I mean, I think, it's a transformation. I mean, it is cooking leaving the kitchen and you know, entering the wherever you keep your TV room. But there still are a few really good shows that teach you how to cook. I mean, the America's Test Kitchen on PBS is you know, you actually can learn how to cook. But by and large, I worry that cooking is dying. And the reason I worry is not out of some sentimental reason, but because we know that people who cook eat better than people who go out all the time.
Well, I've got one hopeful bit of news for both of you on that. My 10-year-olds, they cook like crazy, and they love Top Chef. Go figure.
Well, you know, I think that there's a big hope in that. My son, I have a 16-year-old, too, and he watches these shows, and he does like to cook. And, in fact, he just spent a summer working in a kitchen. And so there is a new generation, perhaps, for whom cooking is kind of cool. And one of the things that these shows are doing is elevating its prestige as something especially that boys can do. It's not girls' work anymore. And that, I think, I take some hope in that development. So your kids are, I think, part of a trend for this generation. Let's hope that develops into something real.
And I can add that I don't cook and I don't watch TV cooking shows. So there you go.
We are going to teach Amy how to cook, Michael. You and me, we're going to get her in.
I think that's a great idea.
Michael Pollan, thanks for joining us. Michael has a story in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine about the rise of cooking shows and the decline of cooking. Take a look.
Maybe the House of Representatives should learn to cook. They head out for the summer recess today, the Senate next week. Do you think they should stay and just get health care done? Or should they go home, take a break, listen to constituent thoughts? What would you tell your representative? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And are you having trouble following the health care debate? Go to our website. We've got all the information there. Here's your takeaway on the economy.
The recovery in GDP that we're seeing is going to continue. And at the end of the year, in January, when we're looking back, we're going to say, wow, look, we started to actually recover sometime this summer.
Well, today the report is the GDP shrank by 1% in the last quarter. That's Lakshman Ajitan, managing director of the Economic Cycle Research Institute, talking about the state of the economy, where you can get all the details. My name is John Hockenberry.
My name is Amy Holmes.
Those are two important details. Here's one more. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
So, ladies and gentlemen, we can report this morning we've done it. Here in America, a classless society.
Who cares if you're a professor at Harvard? That's irrelevant.
Stand up, all victims of oppression.
A Harvard professor. Irrelevant. Finally, there's a dream for America. Beer drinkers dream of a perfect society and talk about teachable moments at the White House. Near beer utopia. That's refreshing. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Get your beer summit analysis here. Good morning. It's Friday, July 31st. I'm John Hockenberry. Amy Holmes is with us all week, former Senate speechwriter, political analyst, and we learn huge friend of Bill Maher.
Yeah, you know, I've known him now a third of my life. Can you believe it?
That's incredible. On the show today, bargoers weigh in on White House beer diplomacy, the high-stakes job of rescuing Marines in Afghanistan, and Bill Maher, for real, on politics and the economy. But first, Charlie LaDuff is joining us from Detroit this morning. We had a lot of response already from bargoers in the Boston area about that beer summit. Charlie, what are the people saying in Detroit?
I don't want to say it in Boston, but in Detroit, they're saying we've got a professor with an overinflated opinion of himself, a cop who's a bigot, president who shouldn't have put his foot in it. And in the end, we're the same place we were yesterday.
That is beautiful, Charlie. They know succinctness and humility in Detroit. Charlie LaDuff, more with you a little later on the program. First, everything you need to know in the news, on the headlines, fresh numbers on the U.S. economy this morning. It shrank at a pace of 1% last quarter. That's better than the Commerce Department expected. Still, a fourth straight quarter of GDP shrinkage. The House is expected to pass legislation today to give the government a direct role in deciding how much Wall Street execs get paid. Up next, stay tuned for this. Representative Bonnie Frank will tell us who gets the power of the purse in this new plan, which gets voted on today. Amy?
The government's billion-dollar Cash for Clunkers program was so popular, it's now broke. The Transportation Department told auto dealers last night to stop offering rebates for folks who trade in their old ride for one that's more fuel efficient. The U.S. general in charge of turning around the war in Afghanistan may ask for more troops. That's as the U.N. says civilian deaths are up about a quarter in Afghanistan so far this year. In Baghdad, at least 28 are dead in bombings that targeted three Shiite mosques as worshippers left Friday morning prayers.
Looking at the weather, NASA says the weather looks good for the space shuttle Endeavour to land at the Kennedy Space Center later on this morning. The Endeavour returns from a 16-day trip to the International Space Station. Bad news in baseball, a new list of 100 players who tested positive for performance-enhancing drugs in 2003. On it, read it and weep, Boston Red Sox David Ortiz and former Red Sox, now Dodger, Manny Ramirez, who helped Boston win the World Series in 2004. Markets were up about 1% yesterday. The Dow opens this hour at 91.54. The S&P starts trading at 9.87, and the NASDAQ begins at 19.84. Futures trading suggests a positive opening for the market. So among the representatives headed out for a summer recess is Barney Frank, who we're going to talk to in just a minute. The House heads out today. The Senate follows suit next week. Do you think these lawmakers deserve a break?
Well, you know, when they go on recess, they're actually working really hard. They're all, you know, lined up to do town hall meetings, meet with their constituents, and raise money
from
their
funders.
Does
Bill Maher think that when we talk to him later on? He may have a more cynical view. What's your view? What should lawmakers be doing on this break? Listening to their constituents, taking a break, or solving health care reform? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. This is The Takeaway. Congress is getting ready for a recess. That means it's tying up loose ends and also dealing with the extraordinary disagreements that have taken place. And we've reported on all this week, Amy, on health care reform. I'm John Huckenberry here with Amy Holmes, who's been with us all week. So it's interesting here on Friday. Joining us now is Representative Barney Frank, one of the senior members of the House of Representatives and also chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, which is getting ready for a vote in the House on a bill to cap compensation packages for bankers who participated in the federal bailout. First of all, Congressman Frank, good morning.
Good morning.
Let's talk about your bill for a second, and then I want to just talk a little bit about the timing. You've got three parts of essentially a regulation of pay packages for people who participate in a government bailout like we've seen.
No, it's for everybody.
It's for everybody.
The rules restricting people who are getting the government rescue money are already in place and they're being administered. But we actually began this before the rescue plan. This bill would apply in various ways to companies, whether or not they take the bailout money. In fact, one of the concerns people have had is that some companies have taken the money, have benefited, have gotten back into a good position, and now are going ahead with the kind of pay that we think is a problem. The second thing is it doesn't cap the pay. It deals with the structure of the pay. It does two things. First, for all public companies, and this is a bill we, frankly, began trying to do in 2006, where we have the problem of too much money being paid, we don't regard that as a government issue, but rather as a shareholder issue. The problem is that in corporations, the pay is set by the board of directors for the CEO. They're very closely connected. There's no labor-management relationship there, no arm's-length relationship. And you had a recent case of one company, 72% of the revenue was going to go to compensation. What we're doing is borrowing something that has worked very well in England. It's called Say on Pay. When the annual proxy form is sent out to shareholders, the company has to include the compensation packages of the top officials, and the shareholders can say whether they approve it or disapprove it. Now, it's not a binding vote.
Well, if it's not binding, how is it going to do anything?
Well, if it were binding, it would prevent people from being paid at all. But boards of directors do not easily reject what the shareholders say. And, in fact, the experience in England where they've had this is that in the last year when a number of those packages have been voted down, they are adjusted downward. Now, that's combined with the Securities and Exchange Commission making it easier for people to challenge members of the board of directors, shareholders. So what we've found in England, and I think it's logical here, and that's a general impression of, for instance, the investor advocacy groups, the shareholder
right.
defense groups, that if you have that and it is voted down, the board of directors will pay attention.
What do you say to the argument, Congressman Frank, and I want to get Amy Holmes in here in just a second, but what do you say to the argument that a lot of people are saying, including New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo, that the barn door is open, the horses are gone, Congress is really lagging behind the compensation packages that continue to proliferate?
In 2006, when the Democrats were still in the minority, I and my Democratic colleagues on the House Financial Services Committee put this bill forward. Unfortunately, the Republicans controlled the House and wouldn't let it be voted on. In 2007, before there was a TARP, we got it through the House as Democrats. The Senate was only 51-49 Democratic. Republicans who opposed it. The Republicans have been very much opposed to this, and it didn't pass. So the answer is that we tried, those of us who were Democrats. Congress is not a unilateral, a monolithic institution. And the fact is that the Democrats had tried on this. The Republicans, it's a party issue, had rejected it. As to the TARP, we did put some tough compensation restrictions into the TARP. But this was a philosophical difference with the Bush administration. They didn't really believe in them, didn't use them much. The Obama administration has been much tougher with those, and that's, by the way, one of the reasons why several of the companies that received TARP money were so quick to pay it back. But the problem is that once they've paid it back, they're under no restrictions, and we are now again trying to put restrictions on. And there's a second piece that says, and this is, I think, going to be even more important. The problem we have is not simply that they pay large amounts, which if the shareholders want to pay out their money, that they could do it, although we want to give them the tools to object. But the way it happens is this. People get bonuses in many of these cases, the decision makers, and the bonuses work in a very interesting way. If the people who are eligible for bonuses take a gamble and it pays off, they make a lot of money. But if they take a gamble and it blows up in their faces, they don't lose anything. So you have an incentive from the compensation structure for people to take too much risk. And that's where you get a systemic problem, because too much risk is taken. And this is something that's been observed by a number of people, Paul Volcker and even Ben Bernanke. And so the second part of our bill is to say to all financial companies, you'll be subject to the Securities and Exchange Commission reviewing your compensation packages. And if you have packages that act this way, that are kind of heads you win and tails you break even, and therefore you're going to take too much risk and cause problems, not just for your company, but for the whole economy, the SEC won't let you do it.
Congressman, this is Amy Holmes here. I think people can understand the idea of taking too much risk, but you said earlier that they're making too much money. Just a simple question. What number is too much?
Whatever the shareholders say, as I try to distinguish, the federal regulation will not go to amounts. This bill has two major parts. What we are saying is that it's up to the shareholders to decide, because it's their money. And that's why we have the say on pay. We do believe that there's a lack of resistance by the board of directors to CEOs wanting more and more money. And we think that, let me say, if I were a shareholder, I would think that 72% of the revenue of a company going to compensation set by the people who are getting it was a mistake. But we don't have a government role here.
But Congressman, let me ask you.
To empower the shareholders, and what we've seen in England is they voted to say no. And that, again, we've worked very closely with the advocates of investor groups.
Sure. Let me ask you this.
Are
shareholders actually asking for this legislation? I mean, is this a constituent group that is lobbying you for this?
Yes, shareholders, and this comes back, as I said, in 2006. It's not so much individual shareholders. There are groups, Nell Minow of the Corporate Library and people in the AFL-CIO Pension Fund. There are institutional investors, people who represent investor interests. And they have been a strong supporter of this, and the strong supporters. And we are working with them.
Pension funds and the like. Well, let's shift gears here for a moment. The vote is going to take place today. You talked about the bill being a response to the fact that there's a Democratic majority suddenly in the House and Senate, and you have the chance to really take action on this bill. But it seems to me that the Obama strategy in dealing with health care this week is actually to shift towards the center, to appease the Blue Dog Democrats and the conservatives, not to push a progressive agenda in the first years of the Obama administration with the majorities in both houses?
Well, I guess I don't understand the relevance of that question to what the committee I chair is trying to do. We are going a little beyond the Obama administration, but in fact, what the Obama administration has tried to do, and I haven't worked as hard in health care as elsewhere, I'm a strong supporter of a strong public
I'm just talking generally politically. It seems like it's shaping out to be...
I don't understand. The first place, there's not just one strategy. There are areas where, and it depends on where you get the votes, to be honest. What's happening in health care, and I have not been directly involved, and I'm a little surprised that, you know, I do think the compensation issue was a very important one and not fully understood. I thought we were going to be talking more about that.
No, we are.
There seems to be some confusion about the, you know, which piece of it does what. But the answer on health care is that I think those who say, oh, well, let me put it this way. I think those who think bipartisanship is an end in itself are wrong. I think it should be a means to passing a bill. Now, where you can get broad agreement, I think that's a good thing. But I would not allow something you could otherwise pass to be diluted.
Well,
one difference is that there does appear to be more political support for these restrictions on excessive risk-taking and giving the shareholders power than there is for some parts of the health care.
Well, Congressman,
so the answer is just a practical one. There are Democratic dissenters on what I would like to see done in the health care, which we don't have in the area of compensation.
Well, Congressman, let's get to that, this idea of strategy with health care. I'm sure you're aware there's a YouTube video of you getting a lot of attention this week where you say that if we get a good public option, it could lead to a single-payer system, and that's the best way to reach single-payer. What do you say about that?
Yes, that's true, because the argument is this. The argument from conservatives is a very contradictory one. One, if you have a public option, that will be a terrible thing for the society. It will be bad. It will undermine health care. And two, that it could lead to single payer. Well, it can only lead to single payer if it's very successful. I think that, in fact, a public option is a legitimate test of single payer, if I'm right. And single payer, by the way, is Medicare. And I think Medicare works much better than the alternatives that preceded it. But the answer is yes. If, in fact, the public option proves to be so popular, that will lead to a single payer system, because more people will gravitate to it. Well, and if it turns out to be the problem that the conservatives think, it won't be. So I think it's a good, legitimate way to test this.
All right, Congressman, though, that seems to be at odds with the political dynamics in Washington. Start small and get bigger. Harder to do things in the second half of the first term. But Representative Barney Franks, thanks so much for joining us.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Amy Holmes. And Mr. President, President Obama, how was that beer last night?
An issue has become so hyped and so symbolic that you lose sight of just the fact that these are people involved, including myself, all of whom are imperfect.
Well, there was the photo, three imperfect people sitting around a white circular table on the White House lawn.
Oh, four. They brought Biden in.
Oh, that's right. Biden was in.
So four. Yeah.
You can imagine the Secret Service behind the scenes going, watching the body energy going, oh, looks like it's getting a little tense. Deploy the SWAT team kind of thing. But what about this moment? President Obama, Sergeant James Crowley, Henry Louis Gates, Joe Biden met for the long-anticipated beer outside the Oval Office last night. We spoke with Charlie the Duff, the reporter with the Detroit News at the top of the hour. He's been taking the pulse of people all over the country about this beer summit. In Detroit, Charlie, you said that people had some pretty succinct, tough things to say about all these participants. Let's carry on with that discussion of what Detroiters on the beer summit.
Well, it was interesting. One guy, he's a political consultant, went to a power bar where a black professor might drink in Detroit. He was interesting. This comes down to class for him. He point blank calls Gates Uncle Tom, because in the sense you got a white job in a white neighborhood with a white wife, you removed yourself from everything, and the minute you got a taste of it, you started screaming. This Detroit's a tough town.
So he says being a professor is a white job.
Let's hear him.
A Harvard professor, you can count him. I mean, be real in Detroit, they're real.
He says, well,
and it's a professional now.
The pay scale at Wayne State is way below that of Harvard's, I guess.
Right.
So Skip Thompson, is this the person that you spoke with?
That's it.
All right,
Thompson.
Let's listen to him.
I call it the, and I hope you don't edit this out, when somebody asked me what I thought about this little quote-unquote summit today, I said, the racist, the Uncle Tom, and the president having a beer today at the White House. See, Skip Gates was extremely upset because he's one of those people who thought he had, again, quote-unquote, arrived, and this is not supposed to happen to me.
Charlie Duff, that is great stuff. Before we go, tell us about this other character that you ran into at Honest John's in Detroit, Sashiko Woods.
Yes. Now, she is a she works at the University of Michigan. She leads a data collection team. Her father is a cop. She says, yeah, it's racist in the sense that if that was an old white man, nobody would have picked him up. Yes, people scream, but her father never would have arrested any man screaming.
Interesting. Well, let's listen to her, because she had the best line of the day as far as I'm concerned.
I tend to think that's secondary, but I think that if he were a white professor, I don't think it would have happened, but the class part played a role too, because he could have mouthed those, like, who cares if you're a professor at Harvard? That's irrelevant. But the point that he showed his ID and he was a resident there, to me, should supersede anything else.
Someone from U of M saying a professor from Harvard is irrelevant. I love that. Charlie the Duff, are you sticking by that? Harvard professors are irrelevant this morning?
Well, it all depends, doesn't it? I mean, I talked to a white guy after the fact. He makes a great point, too, which is the black professor failed the white working class in the sense that he has no idea how they live, which is lots of guys go to jail for lipping off. And if he would have made a statement about the creeping police state, he could have helped us all, but he didn't. He helped himself.
Well, Charlie Duff, thanks so much. Reporter of the Detroit News, taking the pulse of the people in Detroit at the beer summit at the White House yesterday. God, that's great stuff. Harvard professors are irrelevant.
Don't tell Skip Gates that.
No, I won't.
Last week, we reported on the Obama
Obama administration's new initiative, Cash for Clunkers, where you can trade in your old beater for a credit on a new, more fuel-efficient car. The billion-dollar rewards program was supposed to last us well into the fall, but news late last night says Cash for Clunkers may have already cashed out. Joining us this morning with more is our friend Louise Story. Louise is a reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Welcome back, Louise.
Hi.
So can you quickly explain this program? You have a car, you got a beater in your garage. How do you trade it in?
Well, it was a pretty sweet deal for people. You wanted a car anyways. Maybe you didn't buy one in the last year because you're afraid of the economy. And you could go get $4,500 rebate if you bought a fuel-efficient car. And so, not surprisingly, a lot of people jumped and did it.
So you just drive it down onto the car dealer and they hand you a check for $4,500?
I don't know if the check is mailed to you later or if they hand it to you. I doubt it's in cash, but you get this rebate.
But we hear that as of last night, the money ran out. What's going on with this?
So politicians are spinning this as a huge success because they thought maybe it would take months to use $1 billion up. It represents 250 million cars, roughly, that people would have done through the program. So they may extend it, but the real question is that a good idea?
But, you know, Louise, this reminds me of gun buyback programs where, you know, people are handed money for these old, rusty guns that could never have fired or, you know, hunted anything, really. So were people trading in cars that they actually weren't even driving, that were maybe just parked in their front yard?
There'd be a range of cars. There could be 20-year-old cars, but there could also be cars that were a lot younger, that maybe they would have driven for a few more years.
So there seems to be some conflict, though, now between what the Treasury Department is saying and what the White House is saying. Can you describe that, explain that?
I think they're just working out what the next step is. And there was a lot of confusion last night about whether the program would be extended because the fact is the government doesn't have money allocated for it. So they're going to have to look around for money. It might come from the TARP bailout funds, or they might call the program a success and move on.
If you're a bankrupt auto company, there's money for you. But if you just have a clunker, forget it.
So a little political prognostication on your part. What do you think is the future of this program? Do you think that it has to go forward? I mean, it's such a good deal.
Well, it's going to be tough for the government to say we're not going to put more money at this program that's helping the automakers because look at all the money they've given to the banks.
Louise, thanks for joining us. That was Louise Story with The New York Times. And now here are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
The House could pass legislation today that gives the government a direct role in deciding how much Wall Street execs get paid. Representative Barney Frank just told The Takeaway that it would give shareholders power over how much execs take home and also assess their ability to take unreasonable risks in the market. The U.S. economy may have seen the worst of the recession. It shrank at a pace of 1% last quarter. That's better than the Commerce Department expected. And President Obama says this morning that it could mean we're coming back from the precipice.
We were in a position where we could have gone into a Great Depression. I think those fears have abated.
President says job cuts are still a problem. Most economists agree. That says Mexico says it lost 600,000 jobs in the last year. Its economy sank more than 10% in the same time. The Mexican Treasury blames losses on shrinking exports and the H1N1 flu outbreak that forced businesses to close there. Amy?
The U.S. general in charge of turning around the war in Afghanistan may ask for more troops. We'll have more on that situation there up next. In New Zealand, voting has started on a referendum that would throw out a law that makes it illegal to smack a child. New Zealanders have 3 weeks to decide if it should be criminal for parents to use corporal punishment.
So they're voting to throw out a law. That bans it. So they're voting to beat kids in New Zealand.
Well,
what a happy day.
New Zealand was known for being progressive in this regard, but maybe they're regressing.
Well, and back in the U.S., bad news in baseball. New list of 100 players who tested positive for performance-enhancing drugs in 2003. On it, Boston Red Sox David Ortiz and former Red Sox, now Dodger, Manny Ramirez. They helped Boston win the World Series in 2004. Do you think anyone cares?
I think a lot of baseball fans care.
Yeah, they definitely do.
So that's a look at some of the stories we're watching today.
And coming up on The Takeaway, we're going to talk about Afghanistan, a micro and macro look at the war in Afghanistan. Coming right up.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Amy Holmes, in All Week with John Hockenberry. Right now, we're going to check in on what we call Obama's war. July has been the deadliest month in the war in Afghanistan. Yesterday, we spoke to a reporter in Helmand Province in Camp Dwyer. Today, we hear from one of the helicopter pilots, U.S. Medevac helicopter pilot Jay Hanshaw, who actually flies these dangerous missions to scoop up injured Marines on the front line.
Yeah, they fly through sand, and they have to be repaired every couple of days. I remember that from yesterday.
Yeah, it's incredible. He joins us from Afghanistan. Jay, thank you so much for joining us. So, first of all, have you been actively flying missions in the last day or two?
Yes, I have. For the last couple of days, I've been on 6 missions with 18 different patients.
So, Jay, can you walk us through a typical mission? Once you have the injured Marine on board, how do you get out of this, you know, dangerous situation?
It's just once you take off out of the LZ, just kind of, you know, you don't want to come straight and flat and level. You want to change the heading of the aircraft, the altitude. You want to be high and low. You want to use trees, buildings, man-made objects to mass the aircraft to get away from the bad guys so, you know, they don't have a constant sight of you to engage you.
So you told me earlier that you flew 6 missions just in the last 2 days. That must be incredibly grueling.
It is stressful. It's hard. The heat, I think today was like 114. It's really hot out here, dusty, sandy, and it does play a toll on you, but we rest up as time permits when we have any time available, and we kind of lay down and catch naps and kind of reset ourselves and get our senses back and go right back after them.
So you must be seeing all sorts of injuries. What are the most common that you're encountering?
Most common are gunshot wounds and IED explosives.
And what do you see are the results?
For personnel to survive that is better than it was in the past, but they still have some massive treatments and things that they have to go through. I went on the IED blast about 3 days ago. It was a Humvee, up armor Humvee IED, and I've never seen a Humvee that was so destructed or destroyed from behind.
Oh my goodness.
Like I saw that. The driver had an amputee on his right leg. The passenger, he had multiple lacerations on his body, his legs, his chest, his arms, his face. The other soldier that was in the turret above the where they have a 50 cal where they have a weapon system mounted got thrown out of the Humvee, and he had broken arms, his face, lips, his teeth was just horrible. Teeth was all chipped up and stuff from the explosive. And it's not a nice sight to see that, especially with your brothers in arms that's out there fighting for us.
I can't even imagine. Jay Hanshaw, I want to thank you so much for joining us here at The Takeaway and also for serving our country. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
That was Chief Warrant Officer Jay Hanshaw describing the perilous medevac helicopter missions he flies into Afghanistan, Helmand Province, to retrieve injured soldiers. He spoke to us from Afghanistan.
Well, Officer Hanshaw takes me back to coverage of Vietnam, LZ landing zones, how you get the helicopter out of
very
the zone. Very
like
much, very much. The tactics have changed, but sort of the war mission, as we look at a much sort of bigger picture in Afghanistan, comes from Stephen Biddle now. He's a senior fellow for defense policy at the Council on Foreign Relations, who's just returned from a month in Afghanistan. There you hear some of the tactics, the close-up challenges for a helicopter pilot evacuating the wounded. But it's all a part of this surge that's taken place in Helmand Province, 4,000 Marines supported by people like the pilot we just spoke to. Stephen Biddle, what is the state of the surge mission at this point? They want to take territory and hold on to some sort of civilian nation-building mission. How's it going?
Well, in Helmand Province in particular, so far it's been going reasonably well. The casualty level, although it's higher than in quieter times in the war, is lower than some had feared. I think with the resource level that we're devoting to operations in Helmand right now, there's a reasonable expectation that we'll be able to clear the key population areas. And then importantly, to hold them against reinfiltration efforts by the Taliban. The trick at the moment, though, is that the resource level we have in Afghanistan as a whole isn't enough to do what we're now doing in Helmand across the entire country.
Now, when you say resource level, you're talking not just about infantry fighting soldiers, but you're also talking about infrastructure to support those soldiers and, more importantly, the civilian infrastructure that's going to be brought in to actually do the nation building. We're short on all of these, right?
That's right. And even when we're talking about soldiers per se, we need both Western soldiers, and in Helmand there are large numbers of British and American troops operating, but also Afghan national security forces. Wherever possible, we'd like to have the Afghans in the lead with an Afghan face on the operation defending their own country, supported by us. At the moment, the Afghan national security forces are too small and too immature, too early in the training process to be able to shoulder that load.
Which raises the question immediately of something that we were told yesterday on the program, an embed with some of the army units that are in Afghanistan said that the perception among coalition forces is that the Taliban are tenacious fighters and that coalition technological advantages over the Taliban fighters don't necessarily equal the playing field in their view. What do you think of that?
Well, the whole problem in insurgency and in guerrilla warfare generally is that the insurgents adopt methods that tend to mitigate the effect of a high-technology opponent. We've seen that over and over again from Vietnam to the Soviet experience in Afghanistan to Iraq to Afghanistan today. Hiding, the use of covering concealment, intermingling with civilians, operations in difficult terrain, all make it hard for a high-tech military like ours to use its equipment to full effect. You end up being forced into a much lower capital, higher labor form of warfare in which large numbers of troops are a necessary prerequisite for getting the job done.
So there was a report this week, though, that said coalition forces are considering opening up talks with the Taliban. What is that about?
Well, when people talk about reconciliation, as it's sometimes called, in two different forms. One is at the high level trying to drive wedges between the factions that make up the Taliban. The Taliban are not a homogeneous, monolithic entity. It's this fractious collection of actors with very different interests and very different objectives. In principle, you could imagine focusing on some of the differences in goals between different elements of this coalition and trying to peel off or flip some factions. The other way people talk about this is at the retail level, at the individual combatant fighter level, where many of the Taliban's fighters are in it not because of some ideological commitment to Taliban-style governance, but simply to get the pay they need to keep their families fed and housed.
So it's a challenge of hearts and minds and pocketbooks there for the Taliban fighters. 68,000 troops in Afghanistan by the end of the year sounds like it may just be a down payment. Thanks for that. Stephen Biddle is a senior fellow for defense policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks so much, Stephen.
Coming up, I'm going to be talking with Bill Maher, calling in from Los Angeles, host of HBO's Real Time.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Amy Holmes. We're going to look at a case of what U.S. prosecutors say is one of the biggest military hackers of all time, a British man facing charges of hacking into top-secret Pentagon and NASA computers here in the United States, has lost a long legal battle, and now he's being extradited from the U.K. Prosecutors here in the U.S. say that the man, Gary McKinnon, is a major military computer hacker. To tell us more about this unusual case, I spoke earlier this morning to BBC correspondent Rob Broomby, who's been writing about this for our partners in the BBC in London.
Essentially, Gary McKinnon is accused of tapping into U.S. computers, as you say, between 2001 and 2002. He says he was looking for secrets and details to do with sightings of UFOs, which he believed to be buried in these computers, and that the secrets of this had been hushed up. He's always been described as a UFO eccentric. He's known to suffer from Asperger's, which is a form of autism, and he says basically he acted out of naivety. On the other side, of course, we are told that his intentions were calculated to influence and affect the U.S. government by intimidation and coercion. That from Mark Summers, who represented the U.S. government in these cases. Today, he's told that his latest appeal has been dismissed, but I don't think anybody is expecting him to be on a plane to the U.S. just yet. There will be another appeal, I'm sure. His lawyers will want to exhaust every opportunity they can.
So it's our understanding that in the U.K., this case has received widespread attention, even a celebrity mention?
Absolutely. I think he's had a lot of support building up over the months of this. And now recently we've had the Pink Floyd musician David Gilmour, Sting has also been involved. Peter Gabriel has been involved. All have accused the US side of being heavy-handed and called for common sense to prevail. As I say, the defense side maintains he's simply not an innocent man, but a man who's misunderstood because of his condition. At one stage, as I say, he succeeded in hacking into 300 computers at the U.S. Naval. Yes, absolutely. U.S. Naval Weapons Station, Earl, New Jersey, shortly after 9/11.
What's Sting's conception of common sense here, then?
I think the feeling here is that this is a man who has a very unusual mental condition, and that is simply not featured. They now want him to stand trial here in the UK. He admits some of the charges against him in terms of the detail, but says the context was simply misunderstood. He's a man with Asperger's.
That was BBC correspondent Ron Brubby speaking to us from London in an interview conducted earlier this morning.
And since we spoke with Rob there at the BBC, the court made its ruling and the BBC obtained this audio from Gary McKinnon's mother, who spoke to reporters outside the court. Janice Sharp says her son was an easy target.
Robert Gates from the Pentagon said there's tens of thousands of extraditions every month. Are they going to extradite everyone or just one guy who has got Asperger's and was looking for UFOs, who had the naivety to admit to computer misuse with no lawyer? And they thought, soft touch, he'll do.
Well, is he a victim or is he the worst computer hacker or one of the worst human hackers to penetrate Pentagon and NASA computers? That's the question. Janice Sharp also made an appeal directly to President Obama to help get these charges stopped, but the extradition, it looks like it will proceed.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining whether states have the right to legislate the foods and restaurants that people choose. Is it a responsible way to make communities healthier, or does it violate freedom of choice? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Amy Holmes, here with John Hockenberry, and ahead I'm talking with Bill Maher, a friend for years and host of HBO's...
Years and years, apparently.
Ages and ages, and host of HBO's Real Time.
Well, I hope we learn more about that, but right now I got some headlines. Bill moving through Congress before it goes on recess that could give the government big power, or at least shareholders big power, over Wall Street pay. Earlier on The Takeaway, we had a conversation with House Democrat Barney Frank. He's leading the push for the bill.
You have an incentive from the compensation structure for people to take too much risk. And that's where you get a systemic problem.
Critics say the government should stay out of private business decisions, but it is believed this bill is going to pass.
Clunkers? Check. Cash? Well, the tank's almost empty. The White House is reassessing the Cash for Clunkers program. It gives money to new car buyers who swap gas guzzlers for more efficient cars. It's proving so popular, John, that the money set aside is just running out.
Tornado Alley is calmer this year. Federal weather scientists say tornado-prone Midwest and Southwest having an unusually mild season. Space Shuttle Endeavour is on its way home, should be home if weather cooperates. And a quick recap on the GDP numbers we've been talking about. A 1% second quarter dip in the U.S. economy, a brighter picture than earlier this year. We're following all those stories and more this morning.
In the last day before the House breaks for summer recess, the Senate joins them in a week. So you know what that means. Joining us from Los Angeles on the phone is Bill Maher, host of HBO's Real Time. Bill, you've had me on your shows for years now. It's nice to have you on mine.
Amy, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
New career for you?
Well, we've been doing this for this week, and it's been great fun.
You're far too reasonable for right-wing radio.
Well, it's not right-wing radio. It's public radio, so...
That's what I meant to say.
So, Bill, today the House leaves for summer recess. The Senate is following them next week. We're interested in getting your take on how they did these first 6 months. So what are your end of the school year grades for the Democratic leadership? Let's start with POTUS. How would you grade him?
Didn't you have a birthday last week?
I did indeed. You remembered.
Okay, I just had to get that in. The president? Well, you know, I think it's great we have a president who can have a beer after we had a dry drunk for 8 years with all that entailed and all that pent-up hostility. And where
okay,
that
we're talking about Obama, not Bush.
So I'm just saying, you know, when you do have to compare because otherwise you lose perspective. You know, we're back to a truth-based administration, not mm-hmm. that all politicians don't lie to a certain degree. But, you know, it's interesting when you note, for example, last week we found out that the Bush administration had suppressed these pictures of the polar ice cap melting. Mm. You know, I think that tells you a lot about the difference between a year ago and now. Their view was, oh, the polar ice caps are melting. How can we suppress the pictures? Now we have an administration that thinks, oh, how can we fix the problem?
Well, let's compare a year ago to now. I mean, Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, she has managed to drive down her approval ratings below that of your favorite ex-Vice President Dick Cheney. How do you think she's doing?
Well, the Congress, now look, I'm not a fan of the Congress, the Democrats or the Republicans. Obviously, the Republicans are no help and the Democrats are little help. You know, if they punk out on this public option, which is what they're looking like they're going to do now, I mean, come on. You see why the Democrats, I won't become one. Give me a break. If they can't get this done with 60 senators and a majority in the House of Representatives, I mean, talk about a mandate. How about man up? Forget mandate. Man up.
Well, Congress, we had Congressman Wiener on the show, and he...
Congressman Wiener?
From New York.
I'm not familiar with him.
And he shares your views. He's a progressive on the House side, and he
right.
thinks that the Blue Dogs have really gotten in the way and, you know, hijacked the party sort of to the right. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, but I mean, the party had been drifting to the right for the last 30 years. You know, I said a few weeks ago on our show, I think what this country needs, you know, people talk about a third party. We need a first party because the Democrats have become what the Republicans used to be when I was a kid. They are the party, excuse me, of special interest. They're the party of big business. You know, if you want a party that represents the credit card companies and the banks and the pharmaceuticals, I mean, you already have a party with the Democrats.
But let's get back then to Nancy Pelosi. I mean, she's the, you know, from San Francisco, one of the most liberal districts in the country, and she's the Speaker of the House leading the Democrats in the House. So what does it take?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you're asking me to be the guy who defends the Democrats, I'm not your guy. You're thinking of Al Franken.
Which brings me to Joe Biden. Speaking of,
oh, Lord.
So I don't know about you, but I keep thinking that they're going to have to figure out a way to sort of shuffle him off the stage, off the ticket for 2012. Do you think he'll be sticking around?
You know, it's funny. I was talking about that with someone just the other day. Yeah, I couldn't help but notice this week when the Republican talking point came up that what the Obama administration is really trying to do with their health care plan is to find a way to euthanize old people, that they want to come to your door and try to kill the old white people. And I thought Obama's thinking, no, not all the old white people, just Joe Biden.
Oh, my gosh. I shouldn't even laugh at that. Well, you know, I'm going to give the Democrats a little bit of a break on this health care
wow.
sort of, you know, disarray, that it suggests to me that healthcare is just really complicated, really hard. You have so many competing interests that even in the Democratic Party, the Blue Dogs versus the Progressives, I'm not sure that it's so much a problem of leadership, Blue Dogs versus Progressives, just that it's a sixth of the economy the size of France. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. And of course, there's very little honesty about what the real problems are in healthcare. I mean, nobody is really talking about the fact that cost cannot be controlled as long as the profit motive is so prevalent. I mean, the big problem with cost is that doctors order too many tests and services and so forth, much of which is not needed. But, you know, they bought that MRI machine, and damn it, they're going to pay for it.
Well, you know, medical malpractice drives a lot of that. Medical malpractice drives a lot of that.
Yes, absolutely, on that side. And also, you know, the big elephant in the room that I'm always talking about on this show is that, you know, we'll never get health care under control because nobody talks about why people are so unhealthy. It's just accepted in this country that when you reach your, oh, I don't know, 50s, 60s, certainly 70s, you're going to fall apart. The body's natural progression is toward senescence and ill health, which is nonsense. We are in bad shape physically because we are up our lifestyle, because we live a crap lifestyle. We eat the wrong food, and we don't have to be this sick. We live on supermarket junk and pharmaceuticals, and you know, we're just a slightly healthier version of Michael Jackson.
Well, looking ahead to when Congress returns after this August recess, do you have any predictions? What do you think will cap and trade actually, you know, get out of the gate on the Senate side?
Oh, I don't think Captain Crunch would get out of the gate on the Senate side. you know, that's another one that Democrats look like they're punking out on. I sure hope so. You know, I mean, it's interesting to note that cap and trade is, or should be, the conservative point of view. When George Bush's father was president, cap and trade was the Republican conservative solution to pollution. They used it on acid rain. It's interesting to know, we were talking a minute ago about how the country has drifted to the right. You know, the Democrats, again, you know, their position is really the conservative position on this, because the Republican Party, you know, has gone so far to the right that their position on global warming is the world will end when Jesus says it will.
There are certainly some who might take that view. But, Bill, this is so great. Thank you.
No, they've said it. I've heard many people in the Congress, Republican congressmen, have basically said, not basically, they've said it in so many words. And these are some of them who are on the committee. You know, these are important people making important decisions about our survival as a planet. And their view is, you know what? The Bible says God will decide when the world ends. So,
well,
really,
I definitely.
What are we wearing our pretty leads about?
Well, I'm a supporter of the separation of church and state, so I hope that's not the way that these policies are decided. But Bill, thank you so much for joining us. We can always count on you. I can always count on you. Thank you so much.
I was counting on you. I mean, to make you nervous and get me off the line. Uh-oh, he's starting to talk about religion. Wrap up.
Listeners, that was Bill Maher, a host of HBO's Real Time. You can catch a new episode tonight. Thanks so much.
Our religion correspondent on The Takeaway, Bill Maher. Yeah, you were kind of hustling him towards the door there.
Yeah, getting out of that danger zone. Yeah.
So the House heads out for the summer recess today, as they were talking about there. The Senate follows next week. Do you think those lawmakers should stay and get health care done, or do they need to just go home and take a break? Here's a response via Twitter from Baratunde Thurston. Forget skipping recess. Lawmakers should suspend their health care until we get ours. Do you agree? Tell us your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. You're a constituent. Weigh in. We spoke with one of those lawmakers about to go on summer break earlier on the program.
If, in fact, the public option proves to be so popular, that will lead to a single-payer system because more people will gravitate to it. And if it turns out to be the problem that the conservatives think, it won't be. So I think it's a good, legitimate way to test this.
Does a public health care option inevitably lead to a single-payer plan? That's Representative Barney Frank, chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, commenting on health care there uncharacteristically on The Takeaway.
I'm Amy Holmes. Have a great weekend, everybody, but make sure you get to our website first.
That's right. I'm John Hockenberry. Spend your weekend with The Takeaway, won't you?
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.